know why I feel so weird right now.
I don't know why either.
I have to acknowledge the weirdness so that I can get over it. Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drum, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. Still in Portland, Oregon, is my co-host, Richard Wally.
And in California, the LA area, is Cassidy Robinson.
Mm-hmm. Good to have you back.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
You didn't have fun pod cheating on me? It's okay if you did. We're in an open pod.
Pod relationship.
A poly...
Polly Pocket relationship?
Yeah, that seems like Polly Pocket almost. I'm not really sure about it.
I'm pretty sure it's a Pokemon as well. Last week I did an episode with my friend from Chapman University, Alec Ingerson. You can go back and listen to that episode if you want to get all those details. But I know that last weekend you weren't on the show because you went to a convention or something.
A writer's conference, yeah, kind of convention.
I was going to say, you said something like you were excited about it, you were really happy, but you weren't ready to start talking to people again.
Yeah, I'm just, in the wintertime, I kind of enter into my more introverted mode.
You're hibernating.
Well, I'm hibernating, so, that's true. but I'm also, I don't know, I just want to be home. I don't know why. In the summer, I like people. In the winter, I don't. Right. Don't know what the deal is. But I wasn't really ready because I've been working on a book. I'm about 55,000 words in. It's not done. So I just wasn't really ready to like fully talk to anybody about it. But it was still good because it was a lot of information, kind of getting to know. It's called Bizarro Con. Mm-hmm. And the Bizarro is a writing movement here in Portland, a bunch of smaller presses that have kind of banded together. And the way they explain themselves to people is that they're like a good cult section at a movie store, but with books.
Right.
That's what they aim to be. However, the actual term Bizarro, I wanted to know more about what it was exactly, and that's why I went to this conference. And I did get to know that, but I learned that Bizarro is supposed to be a little more left up to your own interpretation of what that means.
Yeah.
And so I think you'll understand this. I don't, maybe the listeners will or not, but it's kind of like the early punk movement. Like, it doesn't really have a definition, but the open definition is the point.
Right, it was kind of more defined by what it wasn't than by what it was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what the Bizarro movement is about. Not only just about, but that's what they want to be, is kind of like, we're this and this and this and not this, this or this, you know. Right. It's kind of a reaction to a lot of different things.
Sure. And you went there and you kind of had some, I don't know, I'm guessing editors or something, other writers look at your work or snippets of it. Would you say that they were pretty open to it, or was it bizarro enough for them?
Oh, I don't know about all that. I mean, it was a conference, so I mean, it was a lot about like more the nuts and bolts of publishing, like
right, how to
like
get published.
Pitching. Well, about pitching. And I did a class with John Skip, who some people might know. He was one of the script writers on Nightmare on Elm Street 5.
And you just recently watched all those movies.
I did, yeah.
That's Dreamchild, right?
Yeah, the one.
Yeah.
Yeah, the kind of weird one. He's a really interesting guy, but he did a class that was called chunk plotting, where basically you just have, you sit down with somebody and you have note cards and you write down, like, he goes, this is the basic way I do it, is I just break it down into three acts. But basically you just kind of have, you just try to get in an hour, you try to plot a whole book.
Right.
You just kind of spitball and just like, just get it out of your system. And it was an interesting exercise and I really appreciated it. It was kind of a more organized way of doing what I kind of already do. So
it's about breaking story more than anything else.
Yeah. And it's just kind of, BizarroCon is kind of like, just like a big celebration of what they do and are and stuff like that. So it's, if you're interested, you can check out, like Erase Red Press, Deadeye Press, Lazy Fascist is one of them.
These do sound like 80s punk labels.
Oh, they kind of are. I mean, no, it really kind of is in a lot of ways. Broken Arrow, I want to say the other one is. Okay. And Fungasm is one.
You could be making these up, and I hope you are. But I would never know.
Yeah, I know. It was good to experience and kind of talk to other writers and kind of network and kind of in really in a more like loose way. Sure. It didn't have to be so formalized.
Today was a really, speaking of Bizarro, it was just a really weird day at work. Like a couple days ago, there was an email chain going around saying on Tuesday at 4 o'clock, you can sign up for basketball or yoga. And okay. I kind of like was like, wait a minute, what is this? Do I have to go? What is this? And then like, I kind of like let the email go for a while. Uh-huh. And then it kept coming back to me. And then I was like, oh, okay, I suppose this is real. So
why is, okay. So Bizarro to you is your work offering you to be
physical activity.
Out.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Keep going.
And I was like, I guess yoga. And then finally the assistant, the head person's assistant came to me and was like, we need you to sign this waiver or whatever if you're going to be doing the yoga. And it's like, I'm like, can I just go to homeroom instead? Like, do I really have to do this? But little did I know, this was like just a component to this all day event that was going on today. They had some HR guy who I assume they hired. I've never met him before. Come in and did these time-consuming exercises with everybody where he split us all into groups, and then we would have to do something like, think of 5 phrases that you think best describe the company or the goals of the company. And then we like break off.
So it was a team-building kind of thing.
Right, yeah. Team-building exercises. Yeah, and then we'd all convene and argue over the semantics of our phrases for like 45 minutes. You know, I got paid for it to essentially sit there and nod.
Yeah, we used to do those at when I worked for the Bengal Theater. We used to do those like once a year.
Yeah.
The first part of the morning, we would talk ad nauseum about what responsibility means.
Mm-hmm.
And for ad nauseum for about 4 hours. And then in the afternoon, we'd do some like big activity thing. Like we'd usually go up to this, like there's this like, it's like a jungle gym for adults. It's like this large wooden structure that was out in the hills, and we'd have to go and climb it and do stuff.
Yeah.
Put little helmets on us. So it was a giant adult jungle gym is what it was. But
that would have been fun.
Yeah. So I know what you're talking about. Those. I actually, see, it's good that you feel like, oh, I got paid for it. I always hated, the jungle gym part was fine. I enjoyed that. But when you have to talk about, like, really inane things, that's when I'm like, can I go to homeroom? You don't even have to pay me. I'll just go sit there. Like, please do not lecture me. I'm a fucking adult. We don't need to talk about responsibility for four right. hours.
Well, I was just kind of blown away because it was like, everybody was participating all day. It's like, don't we run a news site? Like, if everybody's here doing this, like, how are we But yeah, and I mean, I assume that every once in a while, people were on their phones like the entire time. So, you know, and then somebody would go disappear for a little while and come back. So they probably were keeping the site running. But
that's not that bizarre. I'm just saying.
Right. No, I mean, if, and then at the end of the night, like it was, they like playing like beer pong and stuff. It was just a weird day. Not even necessarily bad weird. It was just like I left the assistant guy was parked behind me, so he had to move his car, and I was like, it's kind of like carnival day at school today, wasn't it? And he was like, yes.
So basically what happened, you didn't know this was going to happen.
No, because nobody tells me anything.
You're just so low on the totem pole.
I see. I mean, I kind of knew there was something going on. Like somebody had mentioned this a while back and I just forgot. But I just saw this email chain about like playing sports in the middle of the day. It's like, why? I was like annoyed and kind of like unnecessarily freaking out about it. Like,
so how did yoga go? Let's talk about your feelings.
I went to homeroom instead.
You skipped it. You were bad.
Well, I wasn't wearing any clothes that were appropriate for it. And then I was in the bathroom, cause everything kind of ran late. And by the time I came out of the bathroom, they were like mid, downward dog. So
did the other kids try to get you to smoke while you were hiding in the bathroom? The other bad kids?
No, it's a single use bathroom, which is I was using it. I just went to the desk and actually just wrote some stories and that was my day. So let's go ahead and talk about the movie news. Okay, first news item on the list. I posted this a little while. Neil Blomkamp. It feels like about every 5 weeks we have a story about Neil Blomkamp. He's one of those guys. He's one of those guys that always has something up his sleeve. He has, been attached to a novel called The Gone World, a, sci-fi novel. They're calling it a sci-fi time travel procedural. The book hasn't been published yet, but apparently Fox has already acquired the rights to it. Neil Blomkamp is, you know, one of five or so, directors who are strongly associated with sci-fi material. Mm-hmm. So, he may write and direct it.
Well, I know that they're putting his Alien movie on hold while they're doing Prometheus 2.
Right.
Or Michael Fassbender's Head in the Bag, as I call it.
The Adventures of Nomi Rapace and Headless Michael Fassbender.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I know that they're putting that on hold. It is kind of weird. This is a news article, but it's weird because they're announcing that he's adapting a book, but the book actually isn't been published or released yet.
Right.
And this is a new trend. Like, I don't know if it's a self-publishing because like that's a lot of books are being found that way now.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that's part of the trend. Is it just like somebody self-published it and they found the book and then they're like, oh, well, we're going to pick it up and then we're going to publish it. But then we're also going to make a movie. I'm not really sure.
Right.
But there's really no news besides what you just said. It's a procedural and it has time travel in it. So somewhere between Time Cop and Minority Report.
Maybe. Yeah.
We can only hope for
Jean-Claude Van Damme. That it could be that. I guess the writer of the book's name is Thomas Swederlich. Swederlich? I guess I'm pronouncing that correctly. Yeah, I don't know. I guess, you know, what
is
if...
Is it like
what
a sweater on a leash?
Yes, it is.
I don't know what you're
it's
talking about.
It's very offensive to wherever this person is from.
Well, it's very offensive that you didn't know. You should obviously know that.
I guess we'd have to see, like, wait and see, like, maybe what if the book does terribly? Like, what if it's like it's terrible reviews, nobody likes it? I guess they would just like stop production. They would stop development.
I don't think that's how I see. From what I understand, what happens when they pick up these titles? Because like The Martian was one of these titles.
Yeah,
it's self-published. From some movie, you know, person picks it up and it gets passed to like Neil Blomkamp. Neil Blomkamp and goes, this is good. I like it. I will adapt this.
Right.
And then they adapt it. And then after it's already kind of the machine is going, then they publish the book. So it's like a multi-platform IP kind
like
of thing.
Everything's hyping everything.
Yes.
Right.
There's a comic book, a TV show. It has its own theme song.
A board game.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. I think The Martian had done pretty well as a self-published novel before the rights were picked up, though.
I think when that initially it wasn't.
Yeah. It is.
Because I just read the article on Drew Goddard when he picked it up and actually wrote it. That's what I'm talking about.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. I guess we'll see. What's your first story?
My first story. So Fast and the Furious, there hasn't been enough of them. So what they're going to do instead of trying to keep basically what this article from Variety says is they're going to start doing a Fast and Furious universe where there's a bunch of spinoffs. So in the last movie, they introduced this Secret Service.
Kurt Russell.
Yeah. He was like the secret agent guru guy in the newest movie.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently what they're doing is they're doing a bunch of like spinoffs where like Vin Diesel's character goes on his own, like, solo adventures and other characters. You'll be really excited when they do the Ludacris and what's his bucket?
Tyrese Gibson.
Yeah.
Their spinoff.
Yeah, you'll love that one.
I mean, it could be fun.
So basically, there's not really much to it. They want to do a bunch of spinoffs of it.
Right.
And
this has kind of been the trend like lately for like big Hollywood properties, right? Like they hired a bunch of people to try and make like a Marvel style universe with the Transformer movies. They're going to do this maybe possibly with the Universal Monsters. They want to, at the very least. It kind of seems like it's the ultimate goal because it's better than a sequel. It's a multi-stranded universe where sequels generate other sequels.
Well, in some ways it kind of, I mean, you know, like those Pope novels where there's like 30 of them.
Yeah.
That's kind of what these kind of seem like in a lot of ways. To me, it kind of makes sense. Like some of the things they were saying was basically like with Fast and the Furious, mm-hmm. you can only go so far. I mean, the places that they've already gone are sort of ludicrous.
Right.
Basically within the next like three movies, they're going to have to go into like horror movie kind of like terrain and go like into space or something because.
Right. Or hell.
Yeah. Cause there's yeah. Or hell. Actually, I'd pay to watch both of those, but
I know.
That's when I think a movie series has finally found its legs.
Right. That's when it's ripened.
Yeah, it's gone to space or to hell. or space hell.
Right.
And so I kind of understand where they're going because it's making money still.
Yeah.
And so they're like, okay, let's put they might as well just do a universe cross and have like Riddick. Just have like Riddick versus his whatever his character is from Fast and the Furious.
Yeah.
Have a versus movie as well. No, sure. No. I don't know. It's barely news. They're going to do more of these movies is what they're telling
right.
us.
Right. Well, technically they kind of already started that idea when they did Tokyo Drift, because Tokyo Drift was not connected to the first two.
Right.
Because that was like the characters we know of like Vin Diesel and Tyrese Gibson and da da da. And Paul Walker. And then Tokyo Drift was a new set of characters in a new country. It was just the brand Fast and the Furious was the only thing that was connected to it until the later movies when they brought those characters in with the other characters.
Right. And so they've already kind of played with that.
Yeah.
I mean, it is sort of part of the new universe trend. With comics, it makes more sense because they've been doing that for 60 plus years.
Yeah.
Some of these other titles, it's just kind of like, okay, whatever.
Well, I feel like a lot of people have really hungry eyes when it comes to the possibilities of the multi-universe kind of thing. And that none of these people, you know, these suits and executives who work in Hollywood who make these decisions are, I'm generalizing, I'm sure, know anything about how comic book universes run
right.
and how those stories are written together and, you know, how events, you know, eventually take form.
Well, you have, I mean, essentially with Marvel, you have like, you know, 60, 70 plus years of pre you know, of pre-visualization of the story. Like,
right,
you already
yeah.
have, like, you already have something there. Whereas these, you don't as much. But at the same time, like, I mean, is it really that different than, like, Commando to Rambo to, like, I mean, you have these properties where these characters basically are the same dude through several movies.
Right.
It's just changed just a little bit. Like, I mean, I think we used to joke about how I wanted to do, like, make all of these things attached, and now they're doing it.
Right.
That's what I should really learn, is any bad idea I have, they'll eventually do that.
Oh, well, that segues perfectly into my next story.
Oh, yeah.
So, Christopher Nolan's breakthrough indie hit, Memento, which came out in 2000 with Guy Pearce, pretty much put his, you know, Christopher Nolan on the map. Still to this day, a widely revered kind of semi-art house thriller, kind of sort of Hitchcockian noir told backwards. They want to remake it because I think I read an article, forgot who published it, but the their headline was Memento remake because Polaroids are so 15 years ago.
Well, besides that too, I mean, it didn't make a lot of sense. You have to put it all in time, like in organized, like linear time, so that people can understand the movie, because nobody understood the movie, right? Like, that's what they want to do, right?
Oh, I have a great quote here. I'm reading this off of Variety. They include a big chunk of quote from Ambi, the head company that's going to do this, Ambi Pictures. And I read a little bit about this. Apparently, they're new. They haven't really put a lot out there. And they acquired a big library of films.
Mm-hmm.
And Memento just happened to be one of them. And I'm assuming that Nolan wouldn't have signed off on this, but he probably sold the rights to Memento a long time ago when he didn't know he was going to be the biggest director in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So
to get funding for his next one,
for his next movie or whatever, or just to, you know, pay the bills, like, who knows really. But you know, Memento was based on Jonathan Nolan's short story, and then it made a short film, and then eventually made a movie. This guy, this executive for Ambi, this is his quote on it. He said, people who've seen Memento 10 times still feel they need to see it one more time. This is a quality that we feel really supports and justifies a remake. The bar is set high thanks to the brilliance of Christopher Nolan, but we wouldn't want to try it any other way. What?
That was very vague. So are they saying,
because it's a movie you have to see more than once, it supports and justifies a remake. So are they going to try and simplify it, or is their version just the 11th time you're going to see it? I don't understand the quote, really, other than it just exudes arrogance.
It just seems like they're like, yeah, people liked this, so we should make another one.
Well, it was clearly probably one of the most popular titles they acquired in that big roundup.
See, and these kind of companies that are like pop-ups, they should, the other ones I'm sure that they acquired, why don't they do the Fishmen from Mars? That's what people really want to see.
Right, we were just talking before the air, the, like, you know, boring 90s programmers that nobody remembers. Those are the movies that could use a second take, like movies like Chain Reaction.
Oh, I don't know if that needs a second take. I mean, that movie was already a remake of a remake. It just wasn't owning up to it.
Right. I mean, it was a pastiche of a lot of, like, dumb action movies where there's a bomb about to go off in a timer set. But what I'm saying is that there's a shit ton of movies and nobody remembers. They were made, but they've left no mark on the cinematic landscape. But that's also not the way they're thinking about this. Their thought is Memento's a brand. Memento mm-hmm. has a name to it. They can say in the advertising, you know, inspired by the film by Christopher Nolan. So then that way their poster gets to have Christopher Nolan's name on it.
Well, if they've acquired it, then do they also make money by if it sells more copies, which isn't really.
No, I think it's a different type of rights.
Okay.
Like, it gets kind of complicated and kind of like red tapey, but like there's, you know, there's different, like, there's story rights, and then there's distribution rights, and the distrib the distribution.
That would
rights.
Be part of distribution.
Right? Yeah, they're the ones who are still making money off the DVDs and whenever they showed on TV and that kind of stuff.
Well, I'm really excited that they're gonna take Memento and put it in order.
If that's what they plan on doing. I assume they're probably not going to do very much different to it at all. It's probably going to be a pretty lazy remake. And they're just going to throw it back out there so to see if they can collect a few bucks. And, you know, I think I'm not the only one who feels this way. I still feel that Memento is and was Christopher Nolan's best film. I mean, he's made much more ambitious movies. He's made bigger movies. He's made much more successful movies. But I think if you just look at, like, the nuts and bolts of the story and how it fits together and, like, his puzzle box narrative stuff, all the stuff that he still kind of does, I think that Memento still does that the most efficiently.
It has its merits. The complex nature of it is interesting and intriguing, and it does kind of, it takes you some putting together. And basically, the film itself, I think, I the fact that it's not what it seems, but it is what it seems, is in that repetitive nature of the character.
Yeah.
And how they use him and stuff like that. It is very, it's strangely alluring. It's one of his better films for sure. I'm not.
Mm-hmm. And it's a great Guy Pearce performance. And yeah. It has a few cast members from The Matrix in there.
Joe
Pantoliano. And
I think his performance is really great.
He's really, really good. And so is, what's her name from?
Carrie Ann Moss.
Yeah. Yes. She's really good in it as kind of the unlikely femme fatale. Yeah, I really enjoy that movie a lot.
But you're so into it, you're ready for the remake, right?
Oh boy. Only if they set it in space or hell.
Space hell.
Space hell. Yes.
That's the name of my next book in progress. Hell.
Your next bizarro novel.
TM. Trademark that shit.
We'll mail this podcast back to you. Okay.
That actually isn't legally binding.
I know.
Just word. just so you know. But I did say it online. Space hell. That's mine. That's mine.
Okay. Let's go ahead and get into the movie reviews.
Oh, we do those. Yeah.
Yeah. And today we're going to be reviewing Beasts of No Nation, which is a multi-platform release. It came out both on Netflix, day and date, with a limited theatrical run. And I think a lot of people kind of saw this as an attempt for Netflix to get in on the prestige movie awards contender time. You know, this is November. This came out a few weeks ago, I think about mid-October. But yeah, I think, you know, they brought on Cary Fukunaga, who directed the Jane Eyre movie with Mia Wasikowska and Michael Fassbender. He also directed the first season of True Detective. He almost was going to helm the It remake.
I can tell you're still, there's a little bit of a tinge of bitterness that they didn't make that.
Well, I mean, yeah, you know, it would have been cool to have a real filmmaker make a horror film. There's a lot of, you know, guys out there who pretty much all they do is make cheap horror films, and that's their job. And it would have been nice. I always think that the best horror films are usually by people who don't usually direct horror. And it would have been nice, even though, you know, you could say that True Detective and his style certainly isn't afraid to go there.
He has a style that lends to the genre.
Yeah, certainly.
And I think he's somewhat attracted to it.
Yeah. And he had a vision for it and apparently was too strong for the studio, so he got pushed out of the project. But he did make Beasts of No Nation, sort of under the radar, I think. I don't remember reading a lot about this, like, during the time of True Detective and that kind of stuff, which would have been the time he was probably making it. Do you want to describe sort of what it's about?
Beasts of No Nation is basically, it follows the life of this young man that's kind of swept in, up into the, like, child soldiers of Africa. And it kind of follows from, you know, the time that he's kind of pushed out of his village and his family is killed and all these things. It takes you from that moment to him being swept up into the guerrilla warfare and his journey into becoming a soldier.
Mm-hmm.
The movie itself, I was just looking up a movie that it reminded me of. Give me one moment. We watched it on the podcast. Maybe you can help me with it.
How long ago?
It was, I would say, like, City of God. There we go.
Yes, yes.
It reminded me a lot of the movie City of God in a lot of ways. One way that it really reminds me of that movie is that both movies aren't afraid to show kids doing horrible things.
Uh-huh.
Because sometimes, just depending on where you live and how you grew up, this kind of stuff happens. Specifically, it doesn't look away. It says, yes, this is a child. He has a childlike understanding of the world. But at the same time, he's faced with real adult decisions because of the nature of what he's doing and where he is. I found it really interesting. I really like how it kind of ends, because what it really kind of the whole jux of it is, after you've been through all this, why would you, what does a normal peaceful life offer some people like this?
Yeah.
And even though this is about a kid, like a young kid in Africa, I think it could very much be, like, you know, relevant to, you know, some of our war situation now.
Yeah.
And our vets and what they come home to. And so I think it's a really, while it's a very specific film, which makes it very interesting because it's set in Africa, it also is a very universal film. So I actually dug this quite a bit. It does remind me a lot of other movies, like I said, City of God, and kind of prestige pictures that come out this time of the year. But it comes from somebody that I'm digging their style, and they're kind of a newer voice. And so I give it a little bit more credit, but I think ultimately, by next year, it'll be the next war drama that I'll be looking at. And I might've forgotten about this one.
Okay. So you're saying that you liked it a lot. You think there's a lot of merit to it, but it might be forgettable.
Yeah.
Okay. That's fair-ish. We didn't mention that. You know, one of the main actors in here is Idris Elba, who plays like the head general that recruits all of these orphaned African kids into his rebel army, and you know, uses lots of really insidious ways to keep these kids under control, including, you know, having them getting addicted to heroin and, you know, other means of control and coercion. And it's, I don't know, this movie really affected me. Mm-hmm. And there's, it certainly doesn't skimp on the violence. It really does go there. And, there was some moments in this movie that were really hard to watch,
right,
and really bothered me. And like, not in like a, like I'm morally upset with the movie, but like were just powerful.
How long ago did you watch it?
3-4 days.
Okay.
Yeah.
See, I watched it 3 weeks ago.
Right. Oh. And maybe my overall take of it would be a little bit different. Then
I remember having an emotional affect when I watched it. Yeah. And it was again, the movie is very good.
Yeah.
And there is a pulpability to it. Idris Elba is great in it.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about the coercion and, you know, but at the same time, it shows his charisma, and it also shows that might be the filmmaking. That might be the actor, or probably better yet, a mix of both.
Sure.
But it also shows that he was kind of one of those boys.
Yeah.
And so I find it good because they don't cast it also as good or bad. I mean, this film, I think people should watch it, especially because it's an easy format, straight to Netflix. I didn't see it in theaters, though, and I think that might, I don't know how much it would change the experience.
I wonder that too. I eventually had to watch on my laptop. You probably at least got to watch it on a big screen TV. I watch it on a laptop in my bed with the lights out.
See, that's sometimes I think our difference on our Netflix, on our opinion on Netflix too, is because I watch it in a little bit more grand format
right
than in my lap.
But even in that, I was thinking about like what, how does this look? I was paying special attention specifically to the cinematography and sort of the setups and the shots. And I was like, because it was made for Netflix, I'm looking at the budget. I'm looking at, would this play on a big screen or does this feel like a big TV production? And it does feel like a movie.
It does.
And it, you know, it uses its sets and there's a decent amount of atmosphere all the way through. So it's not just concerned with, you know, digestible point and shoot kind of talking heads.
Well,
sort of stuff like a lot of TV.
There's sort of a like a new kind of thing happening, too, because a movie and TV are kind of overlapping because now that you're not shooting on film, you're shooting on digital, you have more space and more, and also you're saving money on film stock and things like that. So there's kind of becoming more of an overlap. So something like this, which if it was, you know, back in the day on VHS, we're still in VHS days, probably wouldn't have had as big as a budget. It probably wouldn't have worked as well. But now, because there's a format like Netflix, they can make something, you know, that's indie-centric. But, you know, this felt like a mid-budgeter. It really did. And that's a benefit to that's a compliment to everybody involved with it. I'm not saying anything bad about it. Yeah. But what I'm saying is that only now is something like this possible, because before it would have cost too much to do any of this. And you wouldn't have been able to do this anyway, but on like a streaming. So the fact that it could play on theaters and on a small screen is just due to the nature of what Netflix is. They know what they are.
Yeah.
And I feel like as a format, as it comes more and more into its own, which it is, I hope more of this kind of stuff is produced.
And I think it will be. I don't know how well this movie's doing on in the cinema. It probably their theatrical run is the least of what they're worried about. I think they hope to make some money that way, but I think they're more interested in just creating big content that will get awards consideration so that people are subscribing for different reasons other than to, you know, rerun Gilmore Girls. But getting back into the actual movie, I think, you know, you mentioned City of God, which I think is the obvious parallel that I think a lot of people will see, specifically because we're dealing with kids who are sort of lose their innocence at a really, you know, shockingly young age and forced to do horrific, violent acts. However, I also felt a lot of shades of Apocalypse Now in this movie. You know, especially the nature of the plot of them kind of marching through sort of on a journey.
A little more linear, but yeah.
Yeah.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah. And then even a little bit of hints of Thin Red Line in the way he uses internal monologue and that kind of thing and perspective. I thought this was pretty good. It was pretty powerful. My only concession with it, my only feeling of it, as well made as it is and as well acted as it is, I also think this kid, you know, who's basically the main character, Abraham Atah, I think he's terrific in this thing, gives an incredibly nuanced performance and should be as up for as many awards as Idris Elba. I'm not sure what the movie's trying to say ultimately. Is it about the loss of innocence? Is it about war as hell? Is it about the exploitation of underclasses due to these types of skirmishes? It's kind of about all of those things, but never really committed to any one particular thing. And I feel like maybe that's why the movie doesn't connect as much as I want it to, even though, you know, certain sequences and the way that it, you know, feels is all very powerful. I don't know what story it's ultimately trying to tell.
I just thought it was pretty much about like how it degrades the human, how war and how violence degrades the human being.
Mm-hmm.
Like I don't know. I don't necessarily connect to that point.
Which would kind of go back to the Apocalypse Now, kind of scenario, the sort of stare into the abyss thing.
Yeah, that one's so much a Wonderland story, though. This one's a little bit. See, to me, like, I see what you're saying, like the parallels, and that movie is a lot less linear. To me, it's like, oh, he goes and he meets the Mad Hatter, but the Mad Hatter is just a dude, a surfer who really likes to kill people. I love Apocalypse Now.
Right, that movie is definitely a lot more madcap
And I would say
beat with the
that movie is different. It is a different beast. That wasn't supposed to be a pun, but it was. I feel bad about that.
I think
Anyway,
this is a much more human story than Apocalypse Now. I agree with you there, but I think
there's more of an
stylistic,
attachment.
yeah, there's I think there's
Stylistic, you're right.
stylistic stuff that reminds me of it.
Correct. But I mean, as a story, like I think the crux of the story is when they get to, the camp, and everything's good. They're provided for. They're fed. But everything that they're being told and given,
Can't
to
quite shake
me
it.
a little bit. Yeah, to me, it was very much the other movie that I thought of a lot when I watched this was Hurt Locker.
Me too. It has a really similar ending, and even structurally a little similar.
That's why I think that's what the movie's about. So that's why I don't necessarily, my disconnect is more from the time I've spent away from it now. And it feels like, it feels a lot like The Hurt Locker. I don't think about The Hurt Locker that often, truthfully.
You thought
A
about
good
it when you
movie.
watched this movie?
I did. But a movie that always comes, like well, other people maybe not as much, but I think of Zero Dark Thirty a lot more. A lot of people didn't really like that film. So I mean, that's just the nature of an individual's taste, but
Sure.
I really liked Hurt Locker when I originally watched it.
Yeah.
But then, besides this one movie that you're using as a point, there really hasn't been a lot of other times that I've been like, man, yeah, The Hurt Locker. So that's kind of my point of comparison too, is like these are just these war epic dramas that come out each year. It's about as digestible as a Marvel film. It's yes, it's different. It's not as popcorny or anything like that, but ultimately, I think I'll end up forgetting about
Okay. I mean, I'm not as far away from it as you.
it.
It left a little bit more of an impression on me than that. Like I said, it was my disconnect from it isn't because I felt that it was generic. I thought that it was pretty outstanding, especially on the filmmaking level. My connection with it is just I felt that it's a little vague. But
See, I had the opposite. I don't really feel like I didn't feel like it was very vague, but I did feel like but I like the interpersonal like dynamics of it
right.
and seeing that grittiness. But again, it really just comes down to me being away from it. I do think if we were talking about this like the week of, I probably would have gushed more.
Yeah, maybe, possibly. I also thought a decent amount about 12 Years a Slave, because that kind of has a similar structure in that here's this protagonist who gets swept up in this thing he had no business being in, and then it's essentially a victim narrative that plays out, and then he's left with all of this woe.
In a way, this one's more interesting though, because the victim becomes the victimizer, becomes the
Right,
victim,
I
becomes
agree.
the
And maybe that's what the movie's about. Maybe that's more interesting than just the idea of, shouldn't we feel sorry for everybody? He, I think,
Well,
this.
that was never my takeaway.
Yeah.
Like the thing about this kid, this young kid, is like he becomes the next step up. The general that was the little like the second command to Idris Elba,
Yeah.
and then that guy becomes Idris Elba, and then Idris Elba becomes you see the chain of command
Right.
and how somebody rises from this child soldier to, warlord of a nation who can make these like horrible decisions.
And kind of a microcosm, yeah.
And so I don't necessarily, because there's Idris Elba has a specific relation with Abraham Ata in the film, if you've seen it.
Yeah.
And he and you know if you know anything about that, one day that could be Abraham Ata if he's the general.
Sure.
It's kind of a weird chain of passing our horribleness along.
The violence begets violence, kind of thing.
Ish, yes. Violence perpetuates violence. it's a perpetual, or horribleness perpetuates horribleness.
Mm-hmm.
So I dug it on that level.
Would you recommend the movie to most people?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, with the reservation that it's
violent.
It's violent and hard to watch at times.
Yeah. I mean, other than that, it's good. It's an easy format because it's on Netflix. It's digestible.
Yeah, you can certainly see it. It's, you know, you can find it easily.
It's kind of weird because we're at this point where would you go to see it in theater?
I think had I'd seen this in theater and walked out of the theater and was doing this review with it having no day and date release, I would still recommend it. I'm not sure how it all comes together, but I think that it's a really well-made movie. And I think it, like you said, it is an interesting new voice. And it's very different from the other stuff he's done. So, and it shows that he has quite a bit of range as a director.
Well, Jane Eyre to True Detective.
To this, yeah.
To this, which all have a stylistic tone to them, but none of them have. Yeah. But anyways, yeah, I think if it was in theaters, I would. If any of the things we've mentioned are some of, like, really great movies that you kind of go back to a lot, yeah, I would definitely say you should check it out.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, let's go ahead and get into our Netflix homework then, our other Netflix homework. an older movie that you assigned weeks ago called The Strange Color of Your Body's Tears. And I had the hell of a time trying to...
I love you reading it. Just read it again for me.
I wasn't reading it, actually. I was trying to look it up. The Strange Color of Your Body's Tears, which is a Belgian film. It came out in 2013 there. Came out last year here. Now, this will be some reading. Directed by Helene Catat and Bruno Forzani.
Sure.
We'll say that sounds about right. And this is going to be a little difficult to describe, but I don't think that difficult. Essentially, you want to get to the bottom of what this movie is. It's a murder mystery about a guy whose wife disappeared one day. He lives in this hotel, this gorgeous Art Nouveau hotel. Mm-hmm. And he's kind of trying to find or piece together, sort of memento-ish in a way, trying to piece together why his wife left or maybe was killed or whatever. And we drift into a series of sequences that are, you know, these strange, surrealist, fever dream, hallucinatory sequences that are super stylish. What did you think of this movie?
Giallo Lynch.
Sure.
That's kind of what I, this is how I would explain it. It's sort of weird because I would say that there's kind of a overlap between this and, this and, Barbarian Sound Studio, A Girl Who Walked Home Alone at Night or whatever.
Yeah. I said we've been really arty and weird for a while.
Well, they sort of have an overlap in a weird way. But this one, I think I enjoyed the most,
okay,
which is weird. But I don't know, but I would be more likely to go back to the other ones before this one. This one is more about how you feel while you're watching it and isn't really a film about, it's not about narrative.
No.
It's about look and style and how the actual, everything makes you, the visceral quality of it.
Sure.
The emotion. And I would say actually in a way, the way that this is closer to Lynch than a lot of things I've seen that try to mock Lynch. Because I feel like the dream logic, it goes full dream logic.
Yeah.
And it doesn't necessarily, and maybe that's just because it's foreign. And so they just tend to give less shits about that.
About narrative. Yeah.
And, but in general, again, this is about 3 weeks ago for me. The film itself, I still just remember the colors of the film.
Yeah.
Like, again, not to be punny, but to really say that this is a stylistically very beautiful film.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say the actual, reveal of the murder or whatever was really
that surprising or that
that surprising or whatever, but the actual just feel of the film and the actual look of the film, I did kind of gravitate toward. And it's kind of interesting though, but because like 3 weeks ago, I probably would have said the opposite.
Okay, so it's because grown on you a little?
Well, usually these kind of films do. Usually I don't have a very good reaction to a film that is unconventional uh-huh. when I first get a hold of it. But then as I digest it and a few weeks pass, like I actually kind of wish I could review films like this every time we do a film like this, I could have 3 weeks to sit on it. I know that's not the nature of the beast, but the reason why is because you sort of start to see, like, you start to see the forest through the trees. And so I started to be like, oh, this is kind of what it's going for. It's way more about I'm not as worried about what the narrative is. I'm more like, oh, what is it? Oh, this is what it's being.
Right.
So there's some strange, I would see this again and try to kind of, I guess, read into the more sensual and sexual and the sexuality of it mm-hmm. and how we kind of and see if there's more to it, more to this film in those specific scenes, because I do feel like there might be something to do with kind of how we abuse each other sexually. With the juxtaposition with Beast of No Nation, that doesn't sound right. But I just mean it a more conventional, like, gender dynamics way.
Okay.
So,
I like the movie stylistically. I think it's hard not to admire it on that level, especially if you really like a movie that kind of throws it all at the wall. Mm-hmm. And this movie certainly does. I found it a little trite. I thought that not just because it had essentially a simple narrative that just buried underneath a lot of strange exotic sequences. Mm-hmm. And those exotic sequences are done interestingly in and of themselves. Maybe have they just been kind of short films or whatever. I felt it was a little masturbatory. I felt that it was certainly it was paying homage to things like Lost Highway, Dario Argento movies and even like kind of like 60s experimental non-narrative stuff, you know, like psychedelic films.
I didn't mention that, but that's very true.
But I felt like it was more about other movies than it was about itself. And we, you know, we talk a lot about like movies that are cine literate or make a lot of allusions to other things. I think most of these same allusions we mentioned with Barbarian Sound Studio. I don't know. I felt like the movie digressed more than it was, you know, putting me in a dream state. I felt more like it was just kind of going off on these trips just so that it could make these weird little sequences. And that's fine.
I tapped more into it at the relationship level. So
sure. I also thought a little bit about the Alejandro Amenábar movie, Open Your Eyes, which kind of has a similar-ish, I guess, surrealist sense. And it's wrapped up in a mystery as well. But yeah, I don't know. I didn't hate the movie. I sort of enjoyed watching it on like a visceral level, as you said. Like, it, you know, artistically, the movie is, you know, if you were just like to walk into a gallery and this was just playing on the side of the wall to sort of, you know, as a freak out while you're kind of looking at other art.
Well, they kind of open the movie as like a kaleidoscope.
Right.
And that's very much what the movie is in a mm-hmm. lot of ways, is looking through the kaleidoscope and but kind of like how all of that blends to make you feel. I don't disagree with you. I think most of art films, including the Lynchian ones, are a little bit masturbatory. And right. But I think that's kind of the point. Like, if you're not into, you know, spending time kind of digressing and looking at art for art's sake, then this probably isn't for you.
It's really funny that you said art for art's sake, because this whole movie's like, one is making all these visual allusions to Art Nouveau, including the poster, which and the building that he's in, and some of the visuals. And that was one of the like the movement's key signatures as art for art's sake.
Well, see, it subconsciously triggered that in me, so I did something right. I more or less dug it. I might have actually been more on your side a few weeks ago. that's kind of the crux of this review, I feel like. But
can I go back in time and do this podcast with you 3 weeks ago?
It would be interesting experiment. We could do a time cop sort of making illusion. Yeah. Anyway. I think that's the thing though, that I'm kind of, I guess what kind of happens sometimes that you have to look at when you're doing reviews is how time kind of changes our opinions and how it kind of lapses things. So I actually think this is interesting. So that's something, as we've been talking about, I've been thinking about a lot, because I think it really does change your opinion on film.
Right. And I think, you know, wisely, when it comes to movies that are kind of dense or maybe elusive, narratively especially, we always put that caveat in there where, you know, we usually put that caveat in there is, I feel this way right now. I might feel different on a second or third viewing. I might feel different 3 weeks, 10 weeks, 2 years from now. And that could be the case with this movie, but maybe that's maybe why I felt a little less favorable to it is the other stuff we've said that about, is I feel like I think it's ultimately kind of shallow. I don't feel like it has that kind of like that thing, you know, that where I really have to piece it all together. I like I said, if it was just art installation, then it's fine for that. And it's cool to look at. I even think I like that. What was that one movie? Beyond the Black Rainbow. I think I even like that a little bit more than this.
Oh, I mean, that was kind kidding,
of a,
right.
No, I mean, that was kind of a B movie done in a Lynchian style, but I
like this one quite a bit more. I think it has more to it, especially when you're talking, especially when you get into that, what did it, to me, a lot of this, like, cause like you said, I don't feel like most movies and most stories, they're universal, their universality and how they connect to us. None of them are that profound or deep. Like really?
No.
I mean, even when we were talking about Beasts of No Nation, we've seen that narrative before. It's not new. Sure. It's presented in a good way, mm-hmm. a way that kind of like tickles whatever. But you know, this one to me was really just about how, you know,
more how it feels.
It's about how it feels, but it's also about him trying to kind of piece together. I think there's more to it than, because you're saying it's just like there's nothing to it at all. I don't think that that's true. I think that there is something kind of enjoyable, and I think that to me, it's much better than Black Rainbow. Black Rainbow is just stuff happening and fucking colors.
See, and that's how I would describe this movie. I didn't hate it. I enjoyed sort of watching it. My ultimate takeaway from it was a little bit like an Otter Pop. It was just sugar water.
See, I feel like there's more to this one than some of the other ones. I mean, Barbarian Sound Studio, I think you can read into it. I don't feel like it mixed as well as this one. I feel like this one, because it didn't like try to jump between a single, like it was just like, this is Dream Logic, go. Right. Like you knew what it was right from kind of the get go. I kind of tapped into it, and I really tapped into kind of the giallo kind of horror.
Yeah, certain sequences especially.
Well, but again, I think that it does kind of tie together and kind of, him going through and trying to rectify and try to kind of like what went wrong. I don't find that it's that obtuse or that, or even you have to read into it as much as some of like the other ones, some of the other Dream Logic kind of surrealistic.
Right.
Kind of
I mean, I think I don't know. Maybe that's why I felt that way. Is I felt like there is there's a streamlined narrative there, but rather than, you know, using Dream Logic to kind of like piece it together, it's more just kind of digressing into Dream Logic to do strange arty sequences that are just visually appealing. But yeah, I mean, I guess I recommend it as a freak out, but I don't know. I wasn't ultimately that thrilled with it.
Oh, I liked it. I would definitely, these aren't necessarily this type of art house or arty kind of films. Usually isn't my like forte, But if I was in the mood for that kind of thing, which I have the penchant for every once in a while, I would recommend this one if you're like that as well, or if you just like the kind of Lynchian kind of stuff and you kind of dig horror and giallo. Yeah, I think this is kind of cool. So I would recommend it at that level. If you're not into artsy and you're not into like color for color's sake,
right,
art for art's sake, don't. Because you're ultimately not going to enjoy it. So
if you think that watching movies, Spanish or French language movies, is a like punishment, then this one isn't for you, especially. Right. Next week for our Netflix homework, speaking of, I wanted to do something completely different. We've been doing a lot of like art films and a lot of foreign films lately. So I wanted to do something kind of light. And so I'm going to assign the comedy Soap Dish. It's a movie I've heard a lot about. I've seen segments of it in various TV shows and whatever. It's referenced a lot. And it's just one of those ones that I've happened to never catch, and it's been on the Netflix queue for a while. So
I've basically seen it, but I'll give it a shot.
This is a young Robert Downey Jr. performance. Came out in 1991. I think that's pretty much the show. So if anybody has anything to say about that movie or The Strange Color of Your Body's Tears, if you happen to watch it, or Beasts of No Nations, especially as we roll into the Oscar season and we might start hearing about this movie in other avenues, give us your thoughts over at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/jabberpodcast, where we post all of our news items and our episodes when they go up, as well as Twitter at jabberpodcast, all one word. Go there and you can see, I communicate a little bit through Twitter every once in a while. So if you just want to shoot a message to me or say you liked the last episode or whatever, I can respond to you quicker that way. We're on iTunes and Stitcher Radio and Player.fm, as well as the Zune and Windows Podcast Network and Pocket Cast. So we're all over the place now. We're covering all the four corners of the internet. You can read my movie reviews that I do weekly on the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. You can read Richard's stuff over his blog, rdwally.weebly.com. Go check out Brad, Amanda, and Alyssa's podcast, Quarter Life Crisis, if you really want to. They don't really record podcasts anymore. But more importantly, go check out Brad's new webzine, which I contributed a piece to, called Panel and Frame. I think you can find it on Facebook. It's over on Medium is the website launcher, whatever you want to call it. That he used to create the blog. He's had a lot of friends contribute to it recently with a lot of different kinds of content, including short comic books, short stories, critical analysis, film, television, comic books. So go check that out. I think that's where Brad's passions currently lie, more so than in the podcasting realm. And be sure to check out our other friends out there, Leland over in Olympia, Washington, over his comedy podcast, Dampercast, as well as Patrick and his dad over at Make Dad Read Comics, and Patrick's other podcast that he does with his friend Dennis, Almost Educational, which I'm going to be recording an episode with them this weekend. It's going to be on the nature of nostalgia. Is nostalgia a good thing?
Oh, I thought it was about you being poor.
Yeah, we kind of talked about that. He gave me a couple other options, so we're going to do nostalgia instead, which I feel like I have a little bit more to talk about other than just whining. And I'm also going to be on another podcast I don't think I've mentioned on this before called The Listening Party. They're a local LA music podcast. It's kind of like a morning radio show like you would like listen to on your commute, like a Casey Kasem kind of thing. But, with this fun couple, a lot more sex humor in between the songs. And I'm going to be doing a guest spot on their show in a couple weeks. I think it might pop up. The episode will pop up in December.
It's a little bit more eclectic than talk. Like, you're just not getting top 40s like people can.
Right, yeah. The listeners get to submit their own songs based on a theme. And I'm going to be doing movie soundtracks.
Oh, fun. So,
Okay, until then, we'll talk to you next week.
Have a good one.
Bye.
Bye.